The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
More customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors? Not just across town, but across the country. How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Global Reach. This is a show that helps your business find opportunities, manage risks, and develop strategies for winning in the world marketplace. I am so excited today. My guest is Nobel Prize laureate Edmund Phelps. He's the author of this amazing book, Mass Flourishing, How Grassroots Innovation Created Jobs, Challenge, and Change. And I'm being joined also by Charlie Cobb, who's president of the French American Foundation. Usually Charlie's I guess. In fact, he's been one of my most frequent guests, but today he's going to join me as co-host because he introduced me to Dr. Phelps. Dr. Phelps, welcome to Global Reach.
Thanks, Tay. Great to be here.
Charlie, welcome back to Global Reach.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here and a special honor to be with Ned Phelps for this program.
So I want to ask the audience, did you ever wonder what makes some nations flourish while others stagnate? What forces in the U.S., Germany, France, the U.K., Belgium, and other Western nations created not just material wealth, but meaningful work, self-expression, growth? Well, my guest, Nobel, today, he has said that attributes it to modern values that were embraced by these nations, values that fueled widespread innovation and generated what he calls mass flourishing. But the sources of that prosperity, he says, are in danger, and we've all seen it. These modern capitalist countries have been weakened by institutional flaws. They are often stagnant. Real incomes are declining for most of the population. So why? And how do we get things back on track? Well, I have been reading his book, and it is breathtaking in its historical scope. In his conclusions, it is an entire course in economics, just for one thing. But also in the analysis and in his prescriptions for how our nations can get back on track. But first I want to ask you, Ned, what exactly do you mean when you say mass flourishing?
Well, what I mean is that most people, or at least a large proportion of the population, are prospering. They're getting better and better at what they do. They're getting better and better rewarded for it. But also on the non-material side, which is quite important, they are developing a range of experience, and they're growing as people. They know more and more. They know themselves better and better. So there's this self-creation, this sort of becoming. That comes out of all this. So that's a sketch of it anyway.
And you say what powers this is dynamic grassroots innovation.
Yes.
What do you mean by grassroots innovation?
Well, I meant right down to ordinary people. It wasn't innovating wasn't an elitist activity, at least in the 19th century, and I think even that right up to later decades. It was something in which a lot of people in the company could be participating in. And individuals, of course, artisans and so forth, they could also be looking for a better way to produce whatever they're producing, or a different product to produce, a new product to produce. So my sense of the 19th century, and this is most pronounced maybe in America, in my sense, everybody was kind of gripped by this spirit of creating new stuff, weighing new stuff to see whether you want to adopt it or not. And I love, there's a quote by Abraham Lincoln in 1858, sometime before he became president, in which in a lecture, he said, after a lot of touring the country, he said, "Why, in young America, there's a passion, a perfect rage for the new." Now, Lincoln may have been thinking of the people he saw as consumers, but those people were also producers, or those were people in jobs. And I'm sure they had as much passion for the new in their work as they did for the new when they're shopping somewhere.
Ned, this is Charlie. I'd like to follow up, if I could, with a question. You referred to Abraham Lincoln, who was an extremely well-read individual, not necessarily formally educated. What would your message be to young people today? I know in the book you talk a lot about the role of the humanities in the modern economy, but we face a situation now where I think a lot of our young people, as undergraduates, want to go to business school because they think that's how to get a job. So can you flourish in today's economy if you study the humanities, or are young people better off going to business school?
I almost think it's just the other way around, that young people have better chances of flourishing if they, I don't know about immerse themselves, but if they become familiar with the humanities literature, beginning with the heroics that writers like Homer wrote about in ancient Greece, later on you have in the 16th and 17th century you have this vitalist literature of Cervantes, Don Quixote, and Shakespeare. Some of Shakespeare's plays are also very much about acting, about doing things, summoning your courage, and so forth. And then I love the romantic literature in the 19th century. And I think if I wouldn't want to go on record as saying that everybody should major in the humanities in college, but I wouldn't knock it. A lot of people who are successful at the creative end of business are people who had maybe they majored in philosophy or the classics or something like that. It's not. It's certainly not not a bad way to go.
I just wanted to add, because I'm a product of liberal arts schools, and I have found in a career that's rather varied, I have used everything. Every physics course I took, biology, humanity, I've used my Latin. I don't see how you can go forward in such a fast-changing world that changes technically without getting a broad understanding of the whole planetary context. You need to be able to adapt to new business, new situation. And I agree with Ned. You need all of this stuff if you're going to be really. It helps creativity.
Yeah, you're actually
out of context.
So we use this concept from Aristotle. Am I right, Ned? Where you talk about eudaimonia as the concept of flourishing really goes back to Aristotle.
Oh yes, it does go back to Aristotle. Though, you know, in a quick reading, you might not pick it up because he kind of spoils the story by saying that, well, to get that eudaimonia, you should study. And that seems like a kind of a quiet pastime without the excitement that I had in mind. But, you know, poor Aristotle was he had sensational insights, but we have to allow for the fact that he was living at a time when business was probably not very exciting. It was probably trading very routine production. And yes, if you could get a hold of a book, that would be a lot more exciting than what business probably was at that time.
Although I suspect getting on a ship on the wine-tossed sea would have been pretty exciting.
Well, of course, there were the wars. Yeah, that was there exciting, too.
Before we go any further, let me tell our audience a little bit about you. M. Phelps is the McVicker Professor of Political Economy at Columbia University and the director of its Center on Capitalism and Society. His career began with a stint at the Rand Corporation. Back east in 1960, he held positions at Yale and its Cowles Foundation until 1966, then a professorship for 5 years at Penn, and in 1970 he moved to New York and joined Columbia. So you came just as I graduated.
I just missed you.
I was at the School of International Affairs, which is now International and Public Affairs.
Right. Well, I'm right. My office is practically part of that, yeah. I'm in the building, same building.
Well, Dr. Phelps' work can be seen as a program to put people as we know them back into economic models, to take account of the incompleteness of their information and their knowledge, and to study the effects of their expectations and beliefs on the working of markets. He has adopted this perspective in studying unemployment and inclusion, economic growth, business swings, and economic dynamism, in other words, the stuff of our world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in 2006, the Nobel Prize Committee agreed and awarded him the Nobel Prize in Economics. Now, Charlie Kolb, as you all may remember, before he came to the French American Foundation, he was an advisor to George Bush the First as the president of was advisor to the first George Bush and then became president of the Committee for Economic Development, which is the leading nonpartisan business-led research and policy organization that promotes sound macroeconomic policy affecting the U.S. economy. From 1992 to 1997, Mr. Kolb served as general counsel for the United Way, and as I said, he served as deputy assistant to the president for domestic policy and Bush I administration from 1990 to 1992. He also held positions in the Office for Management and Budget and the U.S. Department of Education. So, it's an amazing lineup. Let's just start with a couple of definitions so that we're all on the same page. Can you define a modern economy? Because it's so central to your book and your work and our lives.
Yeah. Well, I could have referred to an economy of dynamism, economy that possesses the dynamism to innovate out of the creativity of its people. But that seems sort of clunky. And since I was arguing this kind of economy couldn't arise until there was a spread of modern values, I just found myself referring to it from time to time as a modern economy.
So what do you mean by modern values? What's the difference between modern and
traditional? Well, we touched on that a little bit before, but there's some important things to say there, I think. Certainly very important is individualism. Now, what's individualism? Well, it probably means different things to different people, but I think that a core part of its meaning is independence. People not depending in a kind of thoroughgoing way on other people, even for their sustenance. They can work for themselves. They can think for themselves. Over a wide range of things, they can act. So there's that starts that sort of the individualism movement, I think, gets started towards the end of the Renaissance in Italy with Cellini and the French essayist. I'm blocking on his name, beginning with M. Montaigne. Yeah, and then another part that modernism, of modern values, I think, is the vitalism that we were talking about, that I touched on before. The importance of getting out there and acting on the world, making a mark, and then finally the third category, which is a little kind of bleeds over into the second, I suppose. The third category I would mention is expressionism, experientialism. It's the idea that life is only meaningful if we have challenges, if we have obstacles to surmount, if we have what matters for our ultimate satisfaction and our personal growth is this voyage into the unknown, taking a big chance about what's going to happen to you in your life. So I think that's what modernism is all about, those three things.
Ned, what are the factors that might cause a modern economy to lose its dynamism or become less dynamic?
Right. Well, I thought of these modern values as, to some extent, elbowing their way into the picture at the expense of some traditional values, which were forced to take a bit of a back seat. but then that's a two-way street, and I think what happened in the 19th century is that some traditional values began to get back their strength. There was a resurgence of a lot of traditional values, and I think that as the modern values had less influence and were less decisive, you got fewer people able or willing to go on a voyage of discovery, a voyage into the unknown. And
We've got to take a break right now. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Sure.
So just hold that thought.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
from the boardroom to you. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Global Reach. I am here with my two stellar guests, Nobel Prize laureate Edmund Phelps and guest and co-host Charlie Culp. So when we went to break, we were talking about the values of a modern economy. One of the things you did, there are competing economic theories that we've seen, particularly through the 19th and 20th century. And the ones you drew the biggest contrast to, and they're still alive today, socialism and corporatism.
Yeah.
And socialism, I think our audience pretty much knows what that is. But can you define corporatism for us?
It's not the easiest thing to define, I guess, but roughly speaking, it's the idea that the government ought to have an involvement, a deep involvement in the economy, that it ought to be prohibiting some kinds of activities, a lot of activities, and discouraging some activities, encouraging others, using subsidies and regulations to reshape the economy as desired. It's kind of a reaction to 18th century liberalism, 18th century laissez-faire, the idea that the best government is the smallest that. That's practical, and it's also a doctrine that doesn't go for state ownership. Why bother with that? Just use the weight of the government to get the enterprises under private ownership to do what the state wants.
In a sense, Ned. Isn't that what we have now in the U.S.? One of the things that interests me is the, and I've talked about it on the show before with Tay, is the growing presence of rent-seeking in our economy.
Yeah.
In other words, you can't get something through the market. You get it through the political mechanism, through PAC contributions, super PAC contributions, et cetera. And what I find fascinating is that my conservative friends who profess that they are in favor of market-driven solutions don't see the inconsistency when it comes to the rent-seeking that is with the campaign finance system. And what I'd like to get your thoughts on this, and I really don't understand why conservatives and liberals in this country can't come together and get rid of the rent-seeking. It seems
as if the liberals and the conservatives switched on that. So
yeah.
The 19th century liberal is now today's conservative, and then
yeah. Well, the liberals don't like Citizens United decision. They want to change that, but the conservatives seem to like the rent seeking. So how can we deal with this? Because I think it undermines the ability of our economy to flourish and to do the things that you talk about, Ned.
Really,
well, Charlie, that's certainly one of the prime examples of what I'm talking about. Historically, it's not the newest example. The German government, when Bismarck was chancellor of the economy, or of the state, I guess, people said the government was like a revolving door. The business people would go in there and petition for what they wanted, and that goes back to Charlie. You know a thousand times more than I do about France, but I think this petitioning the state goes back to earlier times in France, and it's just sort of inevitable. Once it's understood that the government can do whatever it wants to do, then it's a good idea for private actors to see whether it can get the government to do what what they want to do, want us to do.
It's purely rational behavior. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think it's I don't know any way to I'm not sure how best to deal with this, but maybe what is necessary is to have in effect some sort of have a constitutional amendment or some sort of widely supported prohibition that says that, look, the government is not entitled to do these things. So petitioners and lobbyists, you can stay home because the government cannot accommodate you.
You know, this is kind of a little known. Charlie and I have been doing a series, and he really coined its name, called The Arrogance of Institutions.
Uh-huh.
And very much is, and get into it in a little bit later, is issue also of the big corporations, the big banks, all of whom seem to be involved in the rent seeking.
Yeah.
And by the way, well, I'm not against banks and corporations, just to make
no.
it clear. It's the rent seeking which
we would like them to function. We would like them to
exactly.
function in the interest of their customers, their
absolutely
their beneficial owners and others. But as long as we're on this line, how pernicious do you think has been the influence of the Powell Doctrine in really undercutting the importance of the dynamism of this economy and turning it more towards this rent-seeking and
the
lobbying? The Justice Powell in 1978, who urged big corporations to seek political influence and to really seek influence over legislation and regulation by campaign donation. And
uh-huh.
that really seems to have five very close heirs or clones on the Supreme Court these days, if you look at McCutcheon and Citizens United.
Yeah.
How much has that undercut the ability of the U.S. to be the kind of dynamic, innovative society that you think is the ideal?
Well, I think that rent-seeking, lobbying, and all that is a huge part of it. But as I said, I think it just flows naturally from a sort of a change in the philosophy of government that has slipped in since Bismarck's time. That the government is has the right to intervene in all kinds of ways. Basically, almost without limit, and it can't come down in the dead of night, swoop down and take your property from you. there are a few limits, but and I think once you've gone down that road, then it's hard to get back. But look, this is not the. Of course, this is not the only thing that's going on. There's a thicket of regulations. Regulations blanket industry in all sorts of ways. Philip Howard, well-known activist lawyer in New York City, points to. The rules that tightly constrain teachers in schools. They can't do this, they can't do that, and so they can't experiment. They can't they can't have the experience of innovating in education. It's a terrible thing. They've been robotized.
And they're very unhappy about it.
Yeah, Philip's a good friend, Ned, as I think you know, and his new book is The Rule of Nobody, which I would certainly commend to Tay's audience. And, of course, his first book, I think 20 years ago, was a huge bestseller called The Death of Common Sense. And, Ned, he begins to make those arguments, again, going back almost 20 years.
Right, yes.
You know, my mother was a grade school teacher, and her biggest satisfaction was, and she worked with really difficult children, and that was her big satisfaction, was finding ways to get through to them. Well, I know, but it's not only government and regulation. There have been some major changes in corporations. And you have pointed out in the book that yes. as companies have gotten bigger, they're in this their own zone of stability, which is not a zone of innovation. But there have been some other changes, and one I know that particularly concerned you, Charlie, was short-termism.
Yes, yes.
Question on that.
Yeah, it's a concern I have, Ned, about the broader set of values in this country. And there were two economists you probably know, Robert Frank and Philip Cook at Cornell, who some years ago wrote a really interesting book called The Winner Take All Society. And I think their basic point was you've got it started with free agency in baseball, and it went into the entertainment world and investment banking, the legal profession, and now the C-suites of companies, that there are certain professions in this country where if you make it to the top, you get an enormous jackpot in terms of the payout. And the impact of that winner-take-all phenomenon has been kind of to skew the job market, to skew the aspirations of young people. And young people see CEOs, for example, making $20 million, $50 million, $100 million a year and think, well, maybe if I go to business school, I'm just as smart as they are, maybe I can hit that jackpot. Does that winner-take-all approach, which I see as a subset of this issue on short-termism, does that skew the marketplace and create problems for the economy?
I'm sure it does. I'm glad to hear you speak on that. I think that the point you just made is a point I missed in the book. But related to that, I do argue that when somebody gets into the position of CEO, he knows he has only a few years there before he's replaced by somebody else, and so he's intent on getting the biggest possible payoff, the biggest possible reward he can over that period, and that's a short period of time.
Exactly.
So he has absolutely no self-interest in innovative projects that might not pay off for 8 or 10 years. He's completely just, but his incentives orient him completely toward short-term projects, buying back shares to prop up the share price so that his bonus, which may be to some extent tied to share price, is raised along with the share prices. And then the financial sector is at fault here too, because they encourage the CEOs to focus on meeting quarterly targets, quarterly earnings targets, so the CEO is both pushed and pulled to forget about innovation, which tends to be so long-term, such a long-term thing.
So does this, and I agree with you completely in terms of what you've described, does this mean the complete triumph of what Milton Friedman wrote about, I think, in 1970 or 1971, when he said that the sole purpose of the company was to maximize shareholder value, and if you follow that logic, then these CEOs are behaving in a perfectly rational manner.
Yeah, well, I enjoy a highly idealized theory myself, I have to admit, but I think Milton was really being very naive in saying that CEOs should do anything and everything to boost the share price. That's just an invitation to abuse. That would make sense in an economy in which the share owners somehow understood everything in the world and had some sort of uncanny understanding of knowledge, a level of knowledge of how the economy works that far transcends what we actually have. If you had these ideal share owners,
then this
doctrine would be fine. But we don't have ideal share owners. The share owners are about as not much better sense of what's ahead for a company than you and I would.
No, I think you're absolutely right. It's led me to question whether the whole concept of corporate governance that has evolved over the last 30 or 40 years is really realistic, because if you look at how long shares are held now, I remember, you know, when I was growing up, people would talk about their grandparents who held General Motors stock for
three decades. Yeah.
Now we're lucky if somebody holds a share for a fraction of a second. So you don't have investors anymore. investors, along the lines of what you're talking about, you basically have a casino. Our capital markets have become casinos, have they not?
Yeah, sure. That's right.
So this is also when we had Rob Monks on the show talking about the drone boards and the CEOs who were just, I don't think that Milton Friedman was really meant maximize shareholder value quarter to quarter. I do think he was thinking more about the old fashioned kind of shareholder who was the term shareholder. I mean, in the 70s, we didn't have that much of a mutual fund industry, and we didn't have, you know, programmed computerized trading. But it does bring to a mind another thing. In the book, and it's really just in about one paragraph, but you took on a lot of groups who think of themselves as stakeholders in companies, communities, advocacy groups, workers.
Yes.
I actually once wanted to put together a course looking at the stakeholders in the modern global corporation. And you look at the... You take the position that all these people who think they're stakeholders are really undercutting a company's ability to innovate, and they're not really stakeholders. My thought is, if you're in my community and you are influencing my air and my water and my roads, somehow I am a stakeholder. Or if I'm working for you, I'm a stakeholder, but that doesn't necessarily mean I'm guaranteed a job, because as a stakeholder, I feel like I'm supposed to contribute. You know, we're going to go to a break, but hold that thought. When we come back, we'll take that stakeholder issue. And then when we come back, I want to start talking about some of the remedies you proposed. How do we get our countries back on track? And I mean France and the U.S.
France.
Yeah. All right, we're going to go to break. Don't go away. This is even going to get more exciting.
Okay.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to our third and final segment. This is Tay Revez, your host. I am here with Ned Phelps, Nobel Prize laureate. We're talking about mass flourishing and prescriptions for the economy, and Charles Cobb, who is the president of the French American Foundation. And they tell me we've got a caller on hold, Alan Klein.
Hey, Kay.
Hi. You were really excited yesterday about Ned coming on the show. Do you have a question or a comment?
Well, I have a little of each. First, I want to congratulate both Ned and Charles for what has been a very, very informative discussion so far. Well done. I'm picking up a lot of perspective from you both, so thank you.
Thank you.
First comment, France has come up now several times among the discussions. Tay, you mentioned France early in. I spent nearly 20 years running a consulting business in France, where I got to see a lot of companies from the inside, large and small. And I will tell you that compared to the United States, there is still a great repression on entrepreneurial spirit and on innovation. As innovative as France may be, technically, especially in the high tech, there is a tax burden and there is a government intervention and interference in businesses that is overwhelmingly compared to the U.S. And that doesn't mean France is not an innovative country. Look at their technology, their rockets, their trains, way ahead of us on any number of things. And yet, when it comes to the small business person, because you're talking about grassroots, when it comes to the small business person, the entrepreneur, I have found repeatedly that there's a sense of frustration and futility. And I just thought you might want to comment on that if there's agreement or any understanding there.
Mm-hmm. Ned, this is Charlie Schweiss. I'll say a couple of things. First, Alan, I think you're absolutely right. It's what I see. It's what I worry about. And of course, as you know, France is their government is trying to figure out how to get economic growth going again. But they've also got some serious structural problems. It got the highest percentage of government spending per GDP, I believe, in Western Europe, and they also have the highest percentage of public employees,
right.
Government employees, and they've got to change that. Hollande is trying to consolidate some of their regions. That, of course, is creating problems. But the country needs to address these issues, and there are internal structural reforms that have to occur. And, of course, there is this long history of the centralized role that the government has played. That's, of course, reinforced by, as I said, the government spending figures and also the number of people who are on the public payroll as opposed to the private payroll. So I'll stop there, and Ned, you want to comment on this as well?
Yes. As I was listening to you both, it occurred to me to emphasize that although there certainly can be a lot of good could come from an ideal restructuring of the tax system and the regulatory system and all that. But I think at the end of the day, the values, the habits of thinking, the traditions that are so strong in France are such an obstacle to change. To modernity,
yes,
and I think the same is true in the United States. I think it's not just a matter of getting rid of 1,000 pesky regulations. I don't think you will have a big kick to innovation. I remember there was an economist. In Rome, who was heading up the competition council, I've forgotten what it was, in Italy. And he said that from time to time they would break up a company and hoping that this would ignite the industry. And he said, and nothing happened.
Sure. Ned, do I recall correctly in your book that there's a discussion of some of the textbooks that the French youth...
Absolutely, right.
Talk about that?
Yes, in the French and German textbooks that some, if not all, high schools high school students read, private businesses under private ownership are portrayed in a horrible way. The bosses are treated as stupid and unfeeling the companies are viewed as the enemy.
Yep.
Of the good life instead of a potential vehicle for exploration and adventure and exercise of creativity.
Yeah, I've had a number of friends and others say to me that there's actually a hostility in France towards success. They don't know how to deal with it. You can't get too much ahead of the rest of the pack. And, you know, maybe you could say we've gone to the extreme in this country, but France, I think, may have gone to the extreme in actually frowning upon flourishing, if you will.
You know, I don't want to cut everybody off, but we've only got about 6 minutes left. So what would give us a kickstart to get back on the road to this kind of widespread dynamic innovation that you've called about? And I know that I see a lot of young people who seem to me to be very innovative. We've been looking at social entrepreneurs, and I tend to look mostly abroad, so we're seeing them. It was one the other day using the M-Pesa mobile payment system in Kenya to bring agricultural insurance to the rural areas where they had never had it before. In India, they are bringing water to the favelas. It's the wrong term for India, but with vending machines, because these are areas that are served by water once a week, and they've done it in a way that people can afford. So what in the West brings us back to a state of dynamism, of innovation? Let's start with, you've recommended institutional reforms and you've recommended values reforms. Let's start with a couple of innovation reforms, and we've only got now 5 minutes, so we need to do them a little quickly.
Well, I think we have to attack the short-termism that we were all agreed on a little while ago. So, gee, if we can't get that done, I don't know what the prospects will be. That seems to me really basic. I'm not saying it's easy, but we have to reform corporate governance. We have to do a lot of reform of the financial sector so that it's more oriented toward financing innovation.
How would you do that?
Well, so much of what the big banks do is financing governments. I'm not even sure that's an appropriate role for big banks. I mean, it just creates this unfortunate liaison between the banks and the government. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. So there are things like that could be done, but I think so much has to be done at the values level. If I could get into that in our dwindling minutes, you know, the mothers in China and France and America, it seems that they're all the same these days. They're teaching their children to take the job that offers job security, take the job where the money is best, and what we should want instead is for moms to be telling their children, go out into the world and find the most challenging, exciting adventures you can. And then the school system could be similarly, I think, refocused on heroic vitalism, individualism. I think the humanities. schools should be not just teaching a little bit of chemistry and so forth. It should also be teaching about what the humanists sometimes call a life of sufficient richness. Mm. Kids don't have the horizons that they ought to have.
Have you talked to the people running Columbia Teachers School yet?
No, I haven't done that. It's a great idea.
It'd be a good place to start.
Sure.
You have another question?
No, I was enthralled by what Ned was saying. I think he's absolutely right. But I think, Ned, that what you've said reminds me of my earlier point about this winner-take-all society, when you see sort of jackpot returns to celebrities, and it kind of skews the future aspirations of our young people. They don't really want to take the risk, but they want the reward. You know, they want that jackpot, and I've seen this. I have a 17-year-old daughter who, you know, wanted to become a singer and an actress, and I said, look, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. That's great, but just recall that many are called and few are chosen. It's a tough road, and the better to get a grounding in a set of values and then see where it takes you.
You know, I'm a little encouraged. I went back to an event at SIPA, the School of International Public Affairs at Columbia, and there are all of these people involved in doing microfinance and starting their own companies and doing social entrepreneurialism. So maybe what you need to do is catch the next generation and then work backwards to their mentors.
Yeah, right.
Do you have any last comment for our listeners? We've got about 1 minute before we're going to have to close off.
Well, as we were talking, I was reminded I was privileged to have an interview with a very, very high official in a country that Charlie knows so well. And I proposed to him that we reform the school system the way I described. I got very excited about it. And then he said, yes, that's a great idea, but the teachers would undermine it.
How would you get the teachers excited?
I don't know. We have our work cut out for us.
Yes, we do. Listen, I thank you so much. You know, there's so much we didn't talk about. Maybe you'll come back on the show in the not-too-distant future.
Okay.
And Charlie, you'll come back?
Love to.
Wonderful.
Enjoy it. Thank you, Tay.
Thank you so much. And
you,
next
Tay.
Week,
you,
we have another really unusual show. We've got Zephyr Teachout. She is not just an associate professor at Fordham Law, but she's the author of a book that will be out in September that's called, Corruption in America. And it really is looking at the relation between political contributions, the Supreme Court, and this narrowing of a definition of political corruption to right now it's no more than you have to be caught giving a politician a bag of cash in return for favors. And she's going to talk about what that's done to the society, which really fits into the premise that you have in the book, Ned. So more on the arrogance of institutions. Oh, yes. And by the way, she is going to be in the September primary in New York State. She is challenging Governor Andrew Cuomo.
Huh.
Or the Democratic nomination for governor. So I think it'll be a very interesting thing. I heard her at a discussion of the McCutcheon decision by the Supreme Court, and she has some very unusual ideas. Ned, thank you so much for joining this show.
Thank you for having me.
And Charlie, thank you so much for co-hosting.
Honor to be here. Thanks.
I hope, please, if you have any topic you want me to cover, if you have a guest, please send me an email at trr@globalreach-sbi.com. If you want to find Ned's fabulous book, and I recommend it, it is a good read aside from anything else. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on Barnes & Noble's or www.edmundphelps.com. And do look at the French American Foundation site. Thank you all for listening. Please come back again and use the next week to extend your global reach.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.